My family is all from Adelaide. My father's family arrived here in the late 1830s, and my mother's family arrived here a little bit earlier, a couple of years earlier. They camped on the beach at Glenelg. They camped there because there was no Adelaide. They were still trying to decide where to put it. They were roaming around inland looking for water. They had small children at the time. And it's the story of that family that I wanted to explore when I started writing Salt Creek. I'm just going to go through a little bit of my inspirations for writing this book, because although I had known family stories, I'd known about our family history, I hadn't had a great kind of drive to write it. I just had the idea of this book in the back of my mind, something that I might one day like to explore. It seemed sort of interesting, but in a distant kind of way. But I did have these little snippets of family stories that I'd heard my whole life. I basically grew up in Melbourne, but every single school holidays, the minute school stopped, we would come home, we'd pack our bags, and that night we would leave for South Australia because my mother hated Melbourne. And it was like exile for her. So the minute we could leave, we did. So all of my school holidays are Adelaide-based, and it was the place of all of our dearest childhood memories, really. But there was this moment when we crossed that inland route. I think it's the Princes Highway. There'd be this kind of extremely desolate section. It's kind of moonscapey. And my mother would always look out of the window and say, "Look, children, this is where your ancestors lived. Out here in the middle of nowhere, imagine." And there were just these little fragmentary stories that she would recount. These fragments, in effect, became the tent poles of the book that I wrote. One was about Annie, who is one of the characters in the book. Annie, who was her great-grandmother, who ran wild with the blacks. That was always the phrase that came down with the family. She ran wild with the blacks. And we had a great kind of sense of her just rampaging all through the Coorong. And she was a great horse rider. And they all just rode the horses madly everywhere. So there was this Annie who was this kind of mythical goddess figure and quite difficult, I believe. The other fragment was of my great-great-great-grandmother. So this is Annie's mother, who died in childbirth being rowed across the Coorong. They actually lived on the peninsula of the Coorong. Most of you would be aware of the geography of the Coorong. They lived on the actual peninsula. And so she was in the middle of an obstructed labour and they had to row in this desperate search for help and she died. And this is a story that's it's haunted me really my whole life. And I had an obstructed labour with my first child and I remember thinking, no, it's going to happen to me too. And it haunted my mother too, and she woke up dreaming about me being in the middle of an obstructed labour at the time. So there's this kind of great reverberation about this particular story. There's a tiny little fragment of a story about an Indigenous stockman's son who lived in the house with the family. And I hate using these terms, but the term that's used in my distant forebears' diaries is half-caste. So I thought, if it's an Indigenous stockman, there's a white mother, who is that person? And there's no evidence anywhere in the family about it being anyone in the family, but I thought, what if it was that person? What if it was one of these girls in the family? So if I were writing something strictly historical, I couldn't speculate like that. There's no evidence at all. All you can do as a novelist, though, is wonder and put yourself into that little space, that little fragment of space that there is, and let your imagination run. And then there were the stories of heat and hardship and failure, desperate, desperate times. And in fact, they were only there for about 10 years before they left. They tried everything that they could. And although the land had supported the Narrangeri people for 40,000 years, it couldn't support this one family of 12 people or so for longer than 10. They had to give up and they returned to Adelaide and gave up farming, actually. But in all of these family stories, what struck me was that there was very little mention of Indigenous people. They were just incredibly peripheral. And I remember asking my mother about it once and she said, oh, I don't know, I suppose they were around, or maybe there weren't very many there. It was just, don't talk about it. I didn't get the sense of huge shame, just of a kind of obliviousness about it, just not thinking about what they must have displaced at all. Anyhow, so I had all of those stories. And then I had this very strange thing that happened in Melbourne. I was at a writing studio And there was a woman downstairs who was working on a non-fiction account of her distant forebear who lived in South Australia. And we were chatting one day and I said, oh, yes, and who's your distant forebear? Because I've got one too. And she said, oh, you wouldn't know him. And I said, oh, I might. You know, where did he live? And she said, the Coorong. And I said, it's John Barton Hack, isn't it? And she said, yes, how did you know? And I, you know, it's just like, snap. Anyway, she was going off on a research trip to the Coorong the next summer. And so we went along. And that, honestly, is the first time I'd ever, ever been into the Coorong. We were always so desperate to get to the beach that we just kind of zipped on by and thought, thank goodness we didn't live there. But we did go in that summer. And for people who've been there and who feel something about that landscape, it is a great humming, resonant, magnificent place. And I felt like it was an electric shock kind of moment for me. We kayaked up the lagoon and went into the peninsula, found this incredible valleys of shells, the shell middens, which are enormous. It's hard to imagine. I just remember thinking that would be the size of the MCG, like these enormous bowls filled with just thousands of years' worth of cockle shells that have been crushed and polished, and it was all kind of glittering in the sunlight. It was amazing. And I had some children there with me, and as children do, they climbed the sand dunes and then flung themselves off the top, probably not in a very respectful way. This is what they did, and I just sat on the top of it in the lee of a sand dune, and I always carry a little card in my pocket, and I started making notes. I thought, aha, I can see now what it is that has meant my family has kept on talking about this place, despite the failures that they experienced there, that they've continued to talk about this amazing place for more than a century, 160 years. We've been talking about the Coorong in my family and speculating about what happened. And so I started writing while I was there. And for months afterwards, when people said, what are you working on at the moment? I said, oh, just a book. Because I couldn't believe that no one had written this story before. It seemed such a compelling one to me. I just want to talk a little bit about the way writers have a, well, not all writers, but people who have an emotional connection to place feel a sense of ownership of that place. And this was the Coorong that I first saw. It was in 2011, 2012, I think. It was the end of a massive drought and the lagoon was almost dried up. It was incredibly salty. If you got a little bit of water on your skin and it dried, it looked like you had sort of leprous spots on you. Everything was so salty. We got burnt by the salt. And there was just this kind of trough down the centre that you could paddle down. And then these emus stalking you up the side. And they are enormous birds when they get close. So this was the Coorong that we visited. Blazing hot, dried up, salty. And I just thought, wow, and also poor them. So it was really fascinating. This was the sand dunes. And this is just a little bit of the shells that you can see in here. And around the corner there is where there's this huge valley. It really is a valley of shells that I wrote into the book. And the Southern Ocean. So there's this incredible contrast between the stillness of the lagoon, a short walk through the sand dunes, and then this amazing, amazing sea, which I let my children go swimming in, and I'm amazed that they didn't drown. We're used to a very kind of sedate Aldinga Bay. So that was my Coorong. That was the one that I saw. And it seemed like a very sublime landscape to me, but also an incredibly damaged one. So while I was looking at that, I was thinking, wow, what have we done? What have we done to create that world that's so dried up, that's been so damaged? And there were various other signs of environmental damage that we saw at the same time. This is the vision of the Coorong, George Frank Angus's vision. From 1846, well, it was published in 1846, probably drawn a couple of years before. And so about 10 years before my family got there. And you can see it's an Arcadian view of this world. It's absolutely glorious, tranquil, harmonious. You can feel this great quality of a kind of poetic connection that he had with this landscape. A spectacular image. It's the one that appears on the cover of the book. And this is a watercolour that he did at the same time of the dunes. And you can see the beginning of the lagoon. This is Lake Albert and the lagoon heading further south, and all of the water birds that are everywhere. And it's an extremely valuable wetland area. It's Ramsar listed. So sensitive and glorious. So I looked at these and I just thought, oh, interesting, nice, not my coorong. Because this is a kind of unspoiled world. But the world that I was interested in looking at was the spoil. What happened to make it spoil? And so really what I was interested in looking at in this book, which recounts this, I think it's about 8 years, of a family that is based on my family, is what happened to create the beginning of that destruction? What was going on? What were they thinking at the time that they were living there? I don't believe that people are malicious mainly in their actions. I think that they act out of self-interest, and that is very interesting to me. And that's what I wanted to explore, how a person could give up principle and act out of self-interest. So I had this story, I had the family stories, but I also have this awareness that in my family, John Barton Hack is a kind of revered figure, and I didn't want to upset my aunts. And also, he doesn't seem to have been a really dreadful person, but I wanted to write about a really awful person. I was interested in writing about a domestic Captain Ahab, someone who would drag down everyone just to support his own view of himself and his world. It's that Victorian era patriarchal person. He's an empire person. He's entitled to do whatever he wants in the book. And in a way, I saw him as similar to many politicians that we would see. So what I'm interested in is, what are those sparks that make a book come alive to a writer? There were a couple of really key moments for me. The first of these was the extremely lucky discovery of a letter from a distant relative, one of John Barton Hack's daughters called Emily, who wrote an account of the trip down towards the Coorong in 1858. She leapt to life for me. She seemed such a teenager. She had such a voice and a personality. And that's just another one of those little spark moments for me. So she's writing to a school friend, Minnie. She writes, "My dearest Minnie, I suppose you would like me to give you parts of my journal, and shall forthwith give you a part of it, journal. We started from North Adelaide at 11:30 and reached Harnsdorf about 1, where we dined, and stayed to rest the horses an hour or two, started off again about 3 through Mount Barker, wishing very much I was not going any further than there. The resting place we stayed at was Timpat, where we intended staying the night, but it was such a dirty place that we were quite glad to come on here, Langhorne's Creek, 10 miles further than staying there. Mama has borne the journey wonderfully well so far. She's lying on the sofa talking to Papa, and I am lying on the other writing my journal." I just felt very close to Emily the first time I read this. But it became clear as this letter progressed that she was in a state of the most dreadful misery. She was like any teenager who's been dragged off to somewhere she has no interest in being. Further, she had no prospect of leaving. So further on she says, "We breakfasted at Dentford's public house, and Minnie, if you had sat down to that breakfast table with us, you would have been disgusted. Heavy bread, no milk, and underdone. I have never in my life tasted such stuff. About 12:30, we all mounted on the top of the bullock dray and had a very tedious ride going so slowly." And she goes on. The end was the bit that broke my heart, I think. "Write to me, dear Minnie, with any news you have, any news at all. It is very dull here, and I'm afraid I will never leave." From the moment of reading that letter, it was like I had a little Emily voice in my head for the whole time I was writing the book. She would just be kind of narrating my life for me, and I would be going down to the shops and I'd say, "I must pick up a loaf of bread," and I could hear her little voice, a little high voice in my ear, chatting the whole time, and I'd speculate about what Emily might be thinking. But the second moment was, Emily, my Emily, which is how I started writing the Hester character in this book, seemed too close to this Emily, and I found it quite hard to break out and fictionalise her fully. And I had come to a kind of dead end in the book, and I couldn't work out how to get out of it. I didn't even really know what the problem was. Writers are peerless procrastinators. And I was Googling around and I thought, I've always wanted a Matisse jazz print. I'm going to find out where I can get a Matisse jazz print. So I Googled this, found a gallery in London, and I thought that they were just like print prints. I said, oh, I'm really interested in these jazz print series, Matisse's, that you've got. Could you let me know about the prices of some of these works? And I pointed out a couple. She sent back a very prompt reply. She said, oh, yes, they're £30,000 each. Aren't they lovely? I'll look forward to hearing from you. Yours sincerely, Hester Finch. And I just thought, ah, Hester Finch, of course. Of course, that's what your name is. It was just such a moment. It opened up the whole book for me. And the Finch thing, it's partly about the connections that I started to make with Darwin, with natural selection, the Galapagos Island finches, and with the idea of women of that age having access to educational opportunities if they came from a certain class. So this Hester Finch thing was of huge importance to me. I wrote her a letter and said, thank you for the information about the Matisse's. I'm afraid I'll have to decline. But I got in contact with her a year or so ago when it came out in England, and the actual Hester Finch, and she was thrilled. She said, I have got a good name, haven't I? Everyone says that. She's an artist, so it was very appropriate. Okay, so there was that inspiration. But the landscape itself was of huge importance to me. I wanted to look at the metaphorical possibilities of landscape. Landscape to me is so suggestive, so resonant. I can't really imagine writing without it. And so I was looking at the erosion of personal belief, the erosion of family, the erosion of landscape, the erosion of culture. These were the sorts of issues that I was really thinking about the whole time I was writing. The ways in which people, they enact progress, but in an oblivious way, without thinking about the consequences. We all do it. We're still doing it now. We always say, oh, isn't it terrible? Weren't we awful then? But we're awful now too. Same thing happens. I was also extremely interested in looking at the role of women at that time. We think of an era as being a kind of monolith, that in the Victorian era, it was just patriarchy and oppression of women and poverty, no education. But in fact, it was as variable for different groups of people then as it is for us today. If I think about the Melbourne that I exist in, my Melbourne is a very, very small pool. I reckon my actual Melbourne is probably about a 3 kilometre radius of kind of left-wing righty types. And occasionally I go south of the city and I feel very brave. And I think, gosh, they wear strange clothes down here, don't they? And but we all live in these sort of bubble worlds, I suppose. And the bubble world that Hester Finch and her family, her father, Stanton Finch, came from, was a highly educated, extremely respectable, upper middle class, politically active world. I appropriated the world of John Barton Hack for the Stanton Finch character in this book. And his family, his grandparents had been very active in the Quaker movement, it was Quaker inspired, to abolish slavery. His grandfather, John Barton, was one of the original signatories. He was one of the people who recruited William Wilberforce and began that whole process. So they were as enlightened as you could be in that era. They were as active politically as you could be. And yet he came marching into the Coorong and just appropriated all that land as if it had never been used. I think that's a really fascinating thing. Pretty grim though. That was a fascinating thing for me. Now, the next thing is, where does fiction start? So I had my family stories, but there is a point where you can't really make a story out of your family. For instance, John Barton Hack wasn't that interesting fictionally. He was just too pleasant, I suppose. I'm sure he was a little bit difficult in some respects, and he obviously had a ruthless streak. But there was a point where I couldn't really do very much with him, so I just thought, it's not that person, it's a different person. The second problem with my great-great-grandmother and her dying in childbirth, at the moment that I saw this, so this would have been their jetty or a replacement of the jetty that they would have had. This is Panka Point on the Coorong. And I remember rowing up to that and thinking, oh, well, that will not do at all. In my mind, this was kind of an epic journey, this trying to row her to safety. It would have been a howling storm. It had a kind of gothic, overwrought quality in my imagination. Here was this lovely sunny day, and honestly, not a long swim or a long row across the Coorong. So I felt quite disappointed when I saw this and instantly began trying to work out fixes. So what I did was I moved their homestead 10 miles further away and made them row a really long way. I made it a 10-mile row, and I did a huge amount of research into how far you can row in an hour, and all of those calculations are extremely correct. I keep waiting for someone to say, you got those calculations wrong, and I think, no, actually, they're completely right. So that's one of those fictionalising processes, just because it didn't seem very dramatic, this particular row. Also the character of Tull, who is the Indigenous boy who comes to live with them. I was thinking a little bit with him about David Unipon, who is on the $50 note, I think, who was Narrenjeri, and the genius that he had and how quickly he learned. And a few times people have said to me, would an Indigenous boy really have been able to do all of that? He's a very brilliant person. And first of all, why not? And secondly, what about David Unipon? There are many, many records of what incredible students the Narrenjeri kids were, not only all Indigenous children were, and of the incredible efforts that their parents made to get them educated, seeing that that was what was important in this particular culture. They tried very hard to adapt themselves to the force that they were faced with. So there's and then there is the character of Malachi Martin, the murderer. And he was like a godsend to me when I saw how close he was to the Finch family homestead. And I knew very much that I wanted to fit him into the narrative just to create some kind of drive. So those sorts of things are really fascinating things to work with too. But where do characters come from? There's Papa, who's my Captain Ahab person. There's Addie, who is the second daughter, and for me she's the wild younger sister. In a way, it's the Mary and Martha story. Hester is the kind of dutiful, responsible older sister, and Addie, her younger sister, is the one who's just a little bit wild. It's always interesting to me. I can always tell if someone's been a Mary or a Martha themselves. They come up and they say, that Addie, she was so selfish! Or the Addies come up and say, gosh, Hester could have loosened up a bit, couldn't she? Do you think, couldn't she have been a bit more fun? And I just, that's the way it is. That's the way people are. But I wanted to explore with the women what the possibilities were for women and to suggest something about their outlook, that they weren't just natural doormats, that they might have been exposed to ideas. I introduced Jane Eyre into the book. And I wasn't really wanting to make it a very referential thing. I didn't want to build a book around references to Jane Eyre or to suggest that Hester was like Jane Eyre. But what I was really saying was there were possibilities for people to be exposed to these ideas. A girl who lived on the Coorong in the 1850s could have read Jane Eyre if she came from this family. And that was me placing a kind of little, I've thought of that, and this is my answer. It's possible. But also, I was looking at the ways in which these feminist movements kept on rising up. And there was the famous Blue Stocking Society in the mid-18th century that rose up for a while and was felled. And at the time of writing, it was the year that Tony Abbott was the Prime Minister, and I was kind of beside myself. I thought, it's going to happen again, because I'd been doing this research. It's going to be Victorian England. It's going to be the 18th century. It's all going to go to hell in a handbasket. We'll be back ironing every single day. I'm not doing it. And another thing, Tony. I mean, I was really het up. And at the same time, when I was writing, I read this, a Queensland academic saying, women are making such a fuss. I don't know what they're all complaining about. The women on Game of Thrones never have that trouble. They just get on with it. And someone replied, well, it's, you know, they don't encourage murder in our society. And so let's just stick with what we've got, shall we? Or try and improve on that. And there were various other types that I was interested in. So there's a younger, one of the brothers, one of Hester's brothers, is also called Stanton Finch. And he's just a horrible person, really. And I was thinking of a kind of football, one of those undereducated footballers who's not incredibly smart or not incredibly educated. He just hasn't got enough to do with himself. He's a bit in love with his own looks. That's the kind of character he is. A little bit about the process of writing. So this was another image that I took. I take quite a lot of photographs if I'm visiting a location when I'm doing research. I didn't have any thoughts about what I would do with this, but I saw this lizard and one of my children went and lay down about a metre away from it and was sort of looking at it like that. And I remember thinking, oh, that's interesting. And the lizard was okay. He'd lain down quite slowly. And I was writing later, and I thought, oh, I could write a little scene around that. But I wasn't thinking in my conscious self, I will make a scene around that. Only that it seemed an intriguing kind of thing to me to see this. And it became a scene about different perspectives, how if you see one thing one way, it'll be, you know, from above, it's like, it's you know, we're towering over it. But if you were a small thing in there, this would look like a dinosaur coming at you. Yeah, those sorts of things are fascinating. And these are just the incredibly, even though it was drought, these beautiful succulents, which they ate, and I ate some for research purposes. They're fine, yeah. Not as slimy as I thought they would be, more astringent. And this is Salt Creek as it is now. I went at a couple of different times of year, and I couldn't believe the difference. All of the colours change in the winter, like these beautiful Persian rug colours with these lovely red succulents. So this all would have been blinding salt dish, a salt pan in the summer. I was really fascinated by that. It was incredibly boggy all through there. They drained it, turned it into farmland. So whatever you see there now is not what it was. People used to take, it would take them hours to travel half a mile in the winter. It was dreadfully difficult. While I was writing, I was always looking around for contemporary images of what their farmhouse looked like. And it's amazing what comes up if you just write in images, farmhouses, Coorong. This is what I found. A young boy called Charles Babbage was travelling with his father, Herschel Babbage, who was a surveyor and explorer travelling around South Australia, who was employed by the South Australian government to explore and to map things and to interview settlers. And his son, 17 years old, took this, drew this picture. It's not a great picture, but he formed the basis for a character called Charles Bagshot, who is in the book, who becomes Hester's dearest person, and opened up another whole line of... It's one of those examples of research leading to a change in plot. A lot of times people think that you do the research and then you do the writing, but in fact they're growing together the whole time. There's this great intermingling of things and you start imagining possibilities. And I started reading quite a bit about the Babbages. So this is Charles Babbage. Charles Babbage's grandfather, another Charles Babbage, was a great friend of Charles Darwin and was the maker of the prototype computer. And there was, Hester is a really great, like she's very good at mathematics. It was one of my ways of separating myself from her because I'm very bad at maths. So I thought I will never really understand her because she's good at that. But it made her feel very separate. And I thought maybe Hester could get into some correspondence with Charles's grandfather and she could somehow make a prototype computer on the Coorong. I thought, where's she going to get the metal? Maybe she could strip some from broken down carts. They were always, you know, carts were always breaking down on the stock route. And I, you know, I spent about, I don't know, 3 days wrestling over this, trying to work it out. And I had to give it up. I thought it's just going to throw the entire book off on a completely different tangent. It will be Hester, computer genius, heroine on the Coorong. So I had to abandon the computer in South Australia in the 1850s. It would have been good though. And I discovered through this book by Charles Babbage that this property, Kunalpin, which is the country town, was their inland sheep station, which I hadn't known. And on the page there's a little bit of writing that just says John Barton Hack's inland sheep station. I thought, how about that? I didn't know. So now I drive through Kunalpin thinking, the sheep station. And this is his picture of Salt Creek, which was taken the year after Malachi Martin was hanged for the murder of a maid. This is one of the plot points in the book. So these were fascinating sorts of things. They created a great sense of immediacy for me. This is just about the weird inspirations of writers. I always carry these two tiny little stones around in my bag from a beloved beach that I go to. A stone becomes a little feature in the book. And when it came to editing the book, one of the editors said, would they really hang on to that stone for... would they do that? I don't know. It was so weird because I was talking about it to my mother and she said, I always carry one of those stones too. And my daughter said, I always carry one of those stones too. And I've had so many people say, oh, I've got a stone as well. It seems to be a bit of a thing, people carrying these little talismanic objects. So these are some of the things. And these are flints from Chichester that I got while I was there. And I would kind of hold them and feel them between just the sound of them. Seem to bring the past closer, these tactile objects. So it's a little bit like the past is trying to discover itself to you when you're writing. The Babbages became so close to me, and it seemed to feed into the Darwin themes, the themes of what survives, what mutates, what strengthens. It became such an important part of it to me. And it gets very exciting at times like that. Sometimes it's a bit of a grind. But sometimes these little moments happen, you just think, wow. One of the things that I think about historical fiction that is sometimes misunderstood is this idea that it should be a purely historical thing, that it should be only about the past. But I think that all fiction is somehow reflective of the world that it is written in. Any fiction that is written now will in some way reflect the world that it's written in. And I can see in my book now that one of the things I was looking at is how Western civilization impacts on the environment. And that is a terribly 2010s kind of theme to be exploring. It's climate change, environmental degradation, deforestation. All of those things are very contemporary. We all make those sorts of decisions. The other thing I was very aware of, I had not realised until I started doing research, was how little I knew about the dark side of South Australia. My mother and my father, they loved it. I mean, they love it so much here. And I have grown to love it as well. I became incredibly surprised about the absence of information that there was about the past. And this kind of reluctance that there was to acknowledge that. And I remember saying to my mother, did you know? Do you know what went on in the Gold Country? Do you know the kinds of things that happened? And she was, she found it quite hard to face that sort of material. So, for instance, when I saw Alexander Downer talking about his family being nation builders, I was pretty shocked. He was directly responsible for the massacres and for covering up the deaths of more than 600 people in the Gulf Country and failing to protect their rights that were granted under their pastoral leases. More than 4,000 Aboriginal people were dispossessed entirely of their land. Yeah, and that sort of material, I think it is incredibly important for it to come to light. I sometimes have people come up to me after a talk and they'll tell me a little family story. They're incredibly moving. It might be that Indigenous women were known as being wonderful midwives in a district and that the colonial women would always go to the Indigenous women to ask for help. Or in another story, there was a case of a woman who was severely beaten by her husband, who was an alcoholic, and the Indigenous women would keep an eye on him. And when they thought that he was getting dangerous, they would come and kind of take this woman away for a few days and look after her until his binge had kind of worn out. Then they bring her back. Strange stories like that. And then they're not really very well documented. But I just think they're the most extraordinary sorts of things. for us to think about. This is such a fascinating contrast to me. This is another George French Angus picture. His landscape pictures are quite free. They're full of emotion. And in this, these ones become like, they're sort of like museum presentations. They're very still. They're designed to reveal an enormous amount of information about the sorts of weapons they had. There's the nets that are over the top. There's the whale bones that they used to help build the houses. The clothes that they wore, all of these things. But it is like a museum exhibit. There's no kind of movement in it. And that reflects so much of his attitude, that they were there as just like kind of landscape artefacts to depict. So different from his feeling for landscape. And here, it's one of those pictures that to me shows one of the huge problems with colonisation, but to him probably looked like a great day out hunting. And it happened very quickly. Settlers brought out greyhounds, and the greyhounds could outpace kangaroos. And by about 10 years into settlement of the Adelaide Plains, it was very, very hard to find any kangaroos. They'd been hunted out already. That's how quickly it happened. So this is a kind of, it's a kind of what larks hunting scene in one way, but it is also a scene of destruction. They would have been oblivious of it. And here, I think you do get the sense of him being aware of what's happened. This is not even 10 years after the beginning of settlement in South Australia. This is Port Adelaide that he's depicting. Port Adelaide. You can see from this foregrounding of the kind of rubbish and rubble that he's a little bit shocked. I think that's the first time that you get a sense of George French Angus being a little bit shocked by what white settlement has done in this colony. And it's when I really thought, that's how quickly the destruction happened. And that was what I was interested in looking at, that moment when it does happen and how oblivious people are to it. And, you know, I include myself there. I'm sure there are things that I'm doing that are not good. But this book is not all downer. It has some good bits, cheerful bits. I'm just going to read a tiny little bit just to give a sense of what life was like for them. The family had a cheese-making business for a while, and then they ran sheep and wheat. They tried growing wheat as well. So this is Hester's mother is pregnant at this time, hot summer. Such a summer, the house became a taut drum until it seemed a careless match or a spark would explode it into flames. At night it let out its heat in slow groans. I threw off the covers and slept in a shift, and the air was like a hot touch on me. The sky was of the deepest blue and hard overhead and white hot on the horizon, and the air above trees and water trembled and hurt our eyes to look at. Addie and I abandoned our petticoats and rolled our sleeves as high as they would go and undid our bodice buttons too if no one else was about. "Girls," Mama said sharply when she saw us, and we waited until she had gone to rest again and undid ourselves. What grass there was at Salt Creek was sparse and dried quickly, and the cows produced not half the milk of the previous summer. Papa would not admit any concern. He was determined to prove the usefulness of the large moulds, and we must all take our turn stirring the cauldron of hot milk and waiting for the curds to form, even if it was more than 100 degrees in the shade. Through the open doorway of the dairy, Addie and I watched the blacks disporting themselves in the lagoon, all shiny in the blue, the children leaping from the sides of their rafts and plunging about. "I wish I could do that," Addie said. "What would be the harm?" The curds formed and we called Papa, who came up the path, rolling his limp sleeves and wiping the sweat from his face with an old kerchief. He said not a word, just filled the moulds and left them to drain before departing on some other pressing task. We watched until he'd gone and then, "Come on," I said, and took Addie's arm and dragged her along the path, the heat from the hard-packed earth pouring from it and filling our skirts until the house was out of sight. "This can't harm anyone. I shall go mad otherwise." We were damp with sweat and our sleeves would only roll a little above our elbows. The material prickled against our skin and sweat trickled down our faces and necks and legs. We were choking in clothes. We took off our boots and stockings and left them on the shore and lifted our skirts high above our knees and waded into the cool water. Oh, the feeling of it sliding up our legs, a silken density. I shut my eyes. Addie slipped on a rock and sat in the water, and her skirts were like an anemone, and she laughed. I sat too, and suddenly we didn't care, and we were in up to our shoulders with our dresses wafting around us, dragging against us when we moved too quickly, holding us back. Hester! Addie! We turned to see Fred and Tull and Albert. And even though I was shocked that we'd been discovered, I couldn't make myself leave the water. Addie scooped glittering handfuls of water across them. Come in, come in, she screamed. And soon we were all plunging about. A wet dress is not easy to walk in. The folds of material clung to our legs on the way home. If I could see the outlines of Addie so clear, the same must have been true of me. I sent the boys ahead of us. Addie wouldn't stop laughing and gave up on modesty, swinging her boots by their laces and holding her skirts high. And the boys looked back and laughed at the sight. Before we reached home, the skirts were dried stiff as paper. And we crept past Mama's darkened room where she lay panting on her bed and into ours. And when we removed the dresses, they half stood on the floor as if dwindled figures remained within. Thank you all. Yep.